Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Well, hello, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are really excited. We are here at Burnt Church Distillery in South Carolina. Where are we, Buford?
Bluffton,
South Carolina. Bluffton. I always get those mixed up. Buford is the name of the county.
That's right.
And, you know, I should know better because I've got a house on Hilton Head, which is only half an hour from here. So, lovely place. And, you know, we're going to be talking to one of the founders and the president of Burnt Church here. Chris, what's your last name again?
Chris Crow.
So Chris Crow is with us today, and we are so excited to learn more about what Burnt Church Distillery is all about and about, you know, the journey that you guys are on. And, you know, everybody's got their story, and we want to hear about yours, Chris.
Great.
So I don't know, where would you like to start? I mean, this place is incredible. When did you move into this place?
So this was brand new construction from the ground up, and we started the project. We're founded by two brothers, Billy and Sean Watterson, and I started working for them back in 2020, which is about just a few months before we opened in March of 2021. So brand new construction, was able to come on board and, you know, be part of the final process to push across the finish line and get open. Been here ever since, just making whiskey and having a good time.
So were y'all making whiskey before that, or did you start it all at the same time?
Yeah, so we had worked with a consultant to develop our mash bills, and we had our whiskey contract made for us back in 2018, so that when we opened, we had whiskey for sale. We finished our production construction in late 2021 and started producing our own, you know, the same mash bills ourselves. And most of our products that we have on the shelf today have transitioned to our distillate. So most everything that you get when you buy it from us comes from, you know, distilled right here in Bluffton, South Carolina.
And it's all made right here in this building?
It is. We have one SKU called Confession that was sourced whiskey. The confession is that we didn't make it. So that's the only thing that we don't produce here from a whiskey standpoint.
And what about aging? Do you age it here?
We age it here. We have an on-site rick house, and we have a secondary rick house about an hour and a half from here that we keep kind of the newer, bigger barrels that are several years away from, you know, being dumped. Keep those there and just bring in the stuff as it's ready to go here. So
you're making it here, you're aging it, some of it here, some of it an hour and a half north, or which direction?
It's kind of northwest.
Northwest. Yep. So sort of up towards Charlotte area.
Well, hour and a half is only, it's still south of Columbia, so it's still in the state. Yeah.
Still in the state.
Yeah.
So it's still getting South Carolina aging, if you will.
Mm-hmm. All the heat, all the humidity.
All the heat and all the humidity. Yeah. But, you know, and then like you get to the shoulder seasons, like now it's September and, you know, it's the humidity drops a lot.
It does.
And the heat goes down. And so, you know, the liquid that is expanded into the wood can start just to pull out a little bit. And by January, you know, it could be 45 degrees, 50 degrees.
That's correct. That's correct.
So, I mean, then it's like fully in the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's back out again. So you get seasons here without a doubt. I mean, it doesn't get freezing cold here, but you definitely get, you know, four seasons.
Yeah.
And so you do get a lot of, you know, distillate going into the wood, soaking up the colors, soaking up the flavors, coming out of the wood, all of that. So that must be working out pretty well.
It does work out well for us. What we find is that when we first started producing whiskey, we put the first year or so worth of production into 30-gallon barrels. And so a smaller barrel, more surface area for the liquid to touch, and seasons where the summer temperatures are, you know, more sustained than they are in other parts of the country, we find that, you know, when we dump those barrels at about 3.5 years or so, they taste pretty darn good. So we're pretty happy with that. We've transitioned since then. We don't produce anything other than 53-gallon barrels at this point. Right.
So I was curious about that because I ran into a thing called flyover whiskey where you pick the farm that grows the corn out in like Iowa or wherever, and then they make some whiskey for you. You tell them what the mash bill is going to be and all this. And I'm like, and they're going to get delivered to me in 6 months. I'm like, how are you going to age it in 6 months?
All right.
Small barrel.
Very, very small barrel.
Very small barrels. I'm like, okay. All right. Yeah. So you're saying that works pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, we've, you know, again, like I said, 3.5 years old roughly is what we're processing right now. So we're happy with the product. We think it tastes good. It doesn't taste, you know, young like you would think it would, especially if it came out of a bigger barrel. So we're very, very pleased with what we're putting out right now.
But now it's all transitioned to the bigger normal.
It is.
The normal size barrel.
Yep.
And, you know, probably people use, I don't know, you tell me, people use the larger barrel because when you get some evaporation, you know, you can get the floral notes from the air at the top of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
As the whiskey is interacting with the air, you get more of the floral notes that come out of it and that sort of thing. Whereas with a small one, there's not as much air.
That's true. Again, like I said, we're pretty happy with how our products are turning out. We think that they're true to their mash bill, and you know, we're just making it the best we can.
Yeah. What are your are you releasing various proofs like cask strength and things like that? Or are you, you know, what kind of different levels of whiskey are you putting out there?
Yeah. So we settled on a proof back with our trial batches before we even opened the doors here. So obviously we had to know, you know, get the cola, TTB colas approved with a proof and everything. So, and we have not really branched into different proofs. We picked a proof for a product and we stuck with it so far. We are just about ready to launch a couple of things that will change that. So we're going to do some barrel picks starting real soon. We're finalizing the labels and the design for that. And also have a new experience on our tours where you can fill your own bottle.
Oh, cool.
So that will be barrel strength as well. Interesting thing about our barrels and our proof and barrel strength is that we go into most of our core products go into the barrel at 110 proof. And most of our core whiskeys are in the 92, 95, 97 proof. So, you know, 110 down to that is not a lot. But what we found in this environment is that we actually lose proof in the barrel. So we'll put a whiskey in a barrel at 110 and when we dump it, it comes out and it's about 107, 107 and a half or something like that. So it's not too far from bottle strength at that point. Say Anita's Choice, our 6-grain bourbon is 97 proof. So going from 107 down to 97 is not a huge amount of water to be added to it. So I'm anxious to, and I've tasted barrel strength, obviously, of our products. And, you know, they are different. They're subtle, but they are different. So you won't get anything from us like a hazmat type proof or anything like that, because we just can't get there. So.
Right. That's interesting. Cause I think like with evaporation, sometimes the proof would go up.
Yeah. I just, you know, it just shows that, you know, the alcohol, you know, evaporates before the water does. And I think the humid environment that we have most of the year down here, you know, has something to do with that. So that's what we find. And that's, you know, that just goes to show you that different parts of the country, you know, experience different interactions with the, you know, between the whiskey and the barrel. And you just, you know, until you start doing it, you just don't know.
It's so interesting. I mean, as I was telling you earlier off camera that, you know, I've interviewed people from all over the country and everybody's got their story of aging. And it's like, it's all so local.
Yeah.
It's such a local story. I mean, the guy up in Denver was really interesting. He's like, oh, you know, we're 5,280 feet above sea level, you know, but we have a lot of storms that come through here. snowstorms and all this stuff, where so the barometric changes cause the liquid to go in and out of the barrel. And then we take it and we take it up to a ski resort at 8,000 feet and we age it up there for a couple of years. Then we bring it back down here, age it for a couple more years, and then we release it. So, you know, everybody's got their strategy, and it's very interesting, and it produces different tastes. And I mean, it's what you like, you know?
Yeah. I think it's just important for people to understand. And I think people, you know, kind of want this, but like, you know, if you don't want the same old, you know, branch out, and, you know, good bourbon can be made in places other than the state of Kentucky.
That's right.
And, I'm a native Kentucky myself, but, you know, I like what we're doing down here, and I'm proud of what we're doing down here. So.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right. You know, you can produce great product anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to learn about the different temperatures and the different, you know, humidities and everything that goes into this. This mm-hmm. is such an interesting business that way. But did I hear you say a little minute ago, it's 6-grain?
Yeah. One of our whiskeys is a 6-grain bourbon. So it has a lot going on. So,
yeah.
But it doesn't taste, you know, 6-grain can go wrong. And we've done a really good job of, like, you know, preserving that, you know, a distinct flavor. That's really interesting. The secondary grain in that bourbon, is wheat. So it's kind of like a wheated whiskey, but with some character, because it has a little bit of rye in it and has Carolina gold rice and oats, malted barley and corn, obviously. Right. So, it's just, you know, it's like I said, a 6-grain is like a wheated bourbon, but with some additional character notes in there. So
I can't wait to try that when we're done here.
Yeah, we'll give it a shot.
We got to get. We can do it on camera too if you want. You know, because that's going to be unique,
right?
You know, I'm not going to get that anywhere else.
No, it's like when I go to whiskey events and things like that. You know, I people's like, what do you have? I'm like, well, we have whiskey from South Carolina. I have a 6-grain bourbon, and you're probably not going to have a 6-grain bourbon anywhere else at this show today.
Nope.
I have a whiskey made with Carolina gold rice as a primary grain. You're not going to have that anywhere else today. And I have a rye whiskey that uses wheat as a secondary grain instead of corn. And not many people do that either. So we try to be authentic and unique and just a little bit different. So we want to be that product where if you're tired of the same old, we've got something for you. So, and I'll add too, real quick, is that one of the things that we're proud of is the fact that we use all grain sourced from South Carolina. So 100% of the grain we use, even the malted barley, even the rye, comes from South Carolina. So we talked about the aging being local. Well, the grain flavors are local too. So we wanted to make an authentic South Carolina product the best we can make it.
How's our corn in South Carolina?
It grows pretty well.
Does it?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I think of Iowa, you know, even thinking New Jersey, like I'm from Pennsylvania originally, or in Delaware.
And, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of corn up there. In fact,
yeah.
When my dad had me growing corn in his backyard.
Right.
When we were growing up. Like, so we grew corn and watermelon and strawberries just for fun, because it was nice to have fresh food, you know. And so I was growing corn in the backyard when I was, you know, 8 years old.
Yeah, we had a big garden growing up too. And it was just like, you know, you would think that, oh, we'll just plant this much. And then you start to harvest it. And it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's so much.
Anybody want corn? Anybody want, you know?
Giving it away. Except for the tomatoes.
Squash, tomatoes.
A couple of tomato plants and you've got.
It's like they're ripened at the same time. Just like, oh, right. Shoot.
Yeah.
Right.
So you got to get into canning or something. I was never into that.
Right.
I mean, my dad loved the tomatoes. He would just eat them. So.
Good tomatoes and good tomato. I love it.
So what about, like, you and the founders, the Waterson brothers? I mean, like, what's your story? Like, why'd you do this? You know, what got you into this?
Yeah. So, like I said, I grew up in Kentucky, and, after college, I was living in Louisville, and I just, you know, was just floundering as a single person in a big city like that. And, you know, it's amazing what a phone call can do sometimes in your life. And I get a phone call from a roommate from college, just living down here in Hilton Head. And he's like, you know, why don't you come down for vacation? You know, and you ever been to Hilton Head before? Just check it out. So I came down here and I was like, oh my gosh, this place is beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. Probably the same. Probably just like when you came here the first time. Right.
That's so about 25 years ago. The first time I came.
Yeah. So,
like, wow.
Few months went by and he called me back again. He goes, hey, my roommate's moving out and I don't have another roommate and I live, you know, I can walk to the beach from the condo. Won't you see if you can find a job and come down here? So I come down and, you know, meet a beautiful young lady and uh-huh. get married and start having kids and have a couple of kids. And I just wanted to be here, you know, so choose location over profession and just figure out how to make it happen. So,
right.
But I brought with me a love for whiskey and for bourbon. And so, when I heard about this project back in probably 2018 or so, I reached out to the owners, started meeting with Billy fairly regularly, just every 6 months or so, just kind of check in, you know? And, then in 2020, I had the opportunity to, you know, come on board and, be one of the first employees of the company. And, you know, we got to get it across the finish line and, you know, make whiskey together. So I have a really talented distiller. And my head distiller, Peter Thompson, is a native of South Carolina, a Clemson graduate, and has been brewing or distilling for probably a dozen years or so. Has a really good mind for the process and a really good palate. Picks some great barrels when we do our batches. Everything we do is in pretty small batches, typically 15 or 16, you know, 30-gallon barrel batches currently at the most. So, you know, there's no definition truly for small batch, but if we're not small batch, I don't know who is,
right.
Because that's
you're taking
small.
Those off and you're mixing them together,
yeah,
and getting a consistent
yeah.
flavor.
Yeah, we find that we get a really good consistent flavor. So, again, we're proud of what we do.
Absolutely. That's amazing. So I'm always interested to know, like, you know, okay, so you came down here, you picked the location before you picked the career, but
yeah.
You know, your family, when you said, oh, I'm going to be helping these guys distill whiskey, what did your family say? They thought you were nuts.
Yeah, well, I mean, my kids are adults, so, you know, they were kind of excited that, and they knew that I, you know, enjoy a good bourbon. So the fact that I could be in this industry and not have to move away was appealing, obviously. So
right.
especially for a place that's as beautiful as this. So,
yeah.
You know, it was just, for me, it's like, I don't want to say it's a dream job, but it's like, it's not a bad gig. So
yeah.
It's hard. It's not easy. It's easy.
If you make any money doing that, how are you going to do that? How are you going to survive?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You get that, family will tell you the truth, you know?
Yeah. That's
what you got to do it. Cause you love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not easy and it's tough. And being a new craft distillery is, there's a lot of big boys out there with bigger budgets yeah. that, you know, can bully their way through,
right.
You know, distribution and new markets and things like that. So, you know, we've expanded this year a fair amount, you know, once the whiskey that we produced kind of became 3+ years old out of the 30 gallon barrels and, you know, looking at our projections based on our barrel inventory and things like that, you know, we knew it was time to go. So we're, you know, in 7 markets now with various products.
Nice. What are the 7 markets?
So South Carolina first, and then we hit Georgia, coastal Georgia, late 21, and then the rest of Georgia in 22, and then Nashville, Knoxville, late 22, early 23. So that's Tennessee. And then we actually have Anita's Choice in New York City right now. And in 2025, we've launched in Florida and Kentucky and Texas. So Kentucky's brand new for us. Florida's a little more established. Texas is brand new. I'm going there for the first time in October to visit the market. So just getting started, but we're excited about where we're going and can't wait to try to make a dent in the market.
Yeah, those are great markets. Those are great. And you know, you've got a fabulous name. So tell everybody where does this name come from? What is this Burnt Church Distillery?
Right.
What is
right.
that about?
Yeah. So about a mile to the east of here toward Hilton Head, there's a road called Burnt Church Road. So when Billy and Sean were, you know, working on the plan for the distillery and trying to figure out what's the name going to be, what is the marketing plan behind the name? Once we figure out the name, you know, how does it impact our brands that we'll have for our products? One day Billy lives on Hilton Head as well. And one day he was going home and came across Burnt Church Road. He was just sitting there at the stoplight. He was like,
look at that sign.
Look at that sign. I wonder why Burnt Church Road is called that.
Right.
So, you know, he goes home and he Googles it, right? Can't really find a good answer. So he's intrigued by it, intrigued enough to know that, you know, that might be a good name for the distillery. So he hires a historian, and she does a lot of research and comes up with a pretty plausible reason of why that road is called Burnt Church Road. And so we uncovered a lot of stories, local history, and things that were, you know, have never been really publicized or published in any kind of publications. So we actually commissioned a book to be done.
Cool.
That kind of tells the whole story of Burnt Church, but also gets into the history of the Bluffton area, Bluffton Hill, that area, and things like that. So once we kind of understood the name, we decided, you know, Burnt Church is a good name, you know, for a distillery. Let's roll with it. So some nods to the church, you can, you know, with a logo, with a shield and the cross and things like that. So, you know, some of our products like Sippin' Saint Moonshine, you know, confession bourbon.
Right.
So
you have to play on the word,
you know, just that kind of thing. So not all of them are like that, but you know, some are. So
and there is, I actually visited a church. Like if you go down the road on Burnt Church, I think there is a church at the end of the road.
Yeah, there is.
Which, and there's, I think it's May River.
Yeah, the May River's right there. So
May River
Church of the Cross is that's on Calhoun Street down there by the river. So it's a historic church that survived the Civil War and everything. We actually have a couple of doors that were from a renovation project from that church that hang in our place downstairs called the study, which is our history area. And the history area down there kind of has some maps and some images and kind of tells the story of, you know, this area and Bluffton and Burnt Church Road and things like that. So trying to tie in that to our brands and also to our experience when you come to the distillery for a tour, you know, the tours start there.
Right.
Okay. I have a really good tour guide, Clinton, that does a great job for us and about telling the story of the history behind, you know, the area and Burnt Church. And so it's just part of who we are in terms of like just being proud of the community, proud of what we do, and wanting to share our story with anybody who walks through those doors.
And I don't know if these people are involved in this story, but there's a group of people around here called the Gullahs.
The Gullah culture is you know really important around here, and their culture, you know, that's their story to tell, you know. And so but
they have any intersection?
A little bit, yeah. So one of our sister companies that's under the Watterson Brands umbrella is called Ma Daisy's Porch, and that's just opened on May River Road in Bluffton, and it has really good Gullah cuisine, and there's a Gullah cultural center there as well. So, you know, there's, like I said, there's stories to be told here that are good, positive stories, and we're trying to be a part of that.
Absolutely. So y'all that are listening, if you haven't been down here, you got to come down to Hilton Head. You got to come down to Bluffton. You got to learn these stories. I mean, this place is really full of rich history, and it's very, very interesting. And there's an island over there called Dufusky where the Gullahs are from. And like, I guess they're from there. I don't know. But they lived there for a long time, and there's hardly anybody on this island now, but you can buy a house there. There's a Head Point development and there's a golf course over there, but the rest of the island is...
But there's no bridge.
Yeah, no bridge.
Right.
It's pretty much uninhabited, the rest of the island, because there is no bridge and there's no cars. So, you know, you got to drive around in a golf cart or whatever, because you can't drive your car around. So if you want to, you know, run to the grocery store, that ain't happening.
Right.
If you need to take your kids to school, you got to wait for the ferry boat.
That's right.
So there's just a lot of cool stuff around here to check out and a lot of cool stuff to learn. Don't miss out on stopping here. Now this building is just absolutely beautiful. What else goes on here besides just distilling?
So, like I said, we do a pretty heavy tour program. So 3 days a week, we do tours, sometimes 4 days a week in the summertime. We have, mixology classes. We do once or twice a month, depending on the month, private events. You could rent the place out if you needed to have a big event. Semi-private events will, you know, peel off half the tasting room and, you know, give you a dedicated bartender and make it a place where, you know, your, you know, groups can gather. We have an outdoor area called Square 67, that we do music in.
That,
you
know,
right outside there. So nice little area out there.
Beautiful.
And then just recently we took a building next door that used to be a pizza restaurant that is now under our control.
Right.
And we renovated that into a sports pub called called Hail Mary's.
So Hail Mary's.
Church, yes. Hail Mary's, right? Hail Mary. So renovated the kitchen as well. And so we're offering, you know, a new food menu. If you've been to Hilton Head or been to Burnt Church in the within, you know, no sooner than the last couple of months, you know, you've had some food here was pretty good, but, you know, we just wanted to elevate it. So we renovated the kitchen and providing, you know, new food options that kind of fit the area here and have some fun with that too. So we kind of incorporate our products into those as much as possible. So think like a barbecue sauce that's been, you know, reduced down with, you know, Anita's Choice bourbon and things nice. Like that. So just trying to, you know, have some fun with the cuisine as well.
Absolutely. That's great. So I think the first time I visited here as a tourist was probably, I don't know, 3 years, 4 years. I'm not exactly sure when it was, but the pizza kitchen was over there and you could, you know, we were at the bar or whatever and you could order pizza right at the bar and they'd bring it over. And it's like, oh, this is great. You know, it's like pizza and whiskey, man.
Yeah.
What a combo.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I think just not to get too deep into the weeds, but the backstory is the micro distillery industry is relatively young in South Carolina. And when we opened our doors back in March of 2021, you know, there were a lot of blue laws and a lot of limitations to what, you know, we could and couldn't do here. So in March of 2021, when we opened, if Randy wanted to come to Burnt Church Distillery, he could come once per day. He could only have 4.5 ounces of alcohol per day. I did not have beer, wine. I could not have beer, wine. I could not have food. It was a tasting room only. If I made any cocktails, it had to be no other alcoholic ingredients that we don't make. So you could never have a Manhattan because we don't make vermouth.
All right.
I had to close at 7 p.m. and I couldn't be open on Sundays. So how in the world can you make a place like this make sense?
Right.
Right. So fortunately, in late summer 2021, just a few months after we opened, some legislation that had been, submitted or, you know, brought to the House and the Senate, some legislation passed that let us basically operate like a restaurant. So all of a sudden, you know, we could be open past 7. We could serve as much as we can serve you responsibly.
Right.
I could obtain a beer wine license. I could do a liquor by the drink license where I could bring in other liquors. And, but the caveat was you had to have a kitchen.
Okay.
Well, we didn't design this place to have a kitchen.
But there was one right next
door. There's one right next door. So we used a little bar area here in the tasting room as a little of a kitchen and then had the pizza place next door. We put their menu on our point of sale system, and that was very beneficial for us. And it was, you know, it was just a really, I don't know where we'd be today if we didn't have, you know, that law change and that opportunity. So it's led us to where we are today, where we've now taken over the pizza place. We renovated it, put in, you know, fryers and a cooktop and a hood system and everything. So we can make about whatever we want, from a food standpoint. So we're just getting started with the new menu and we're going to continue to make progress and make changes and elevate the cuisine to match the location.
Right. That's fantastic.
We're excited.
Yeah. So how many barrels a year or however you, how would you measure cases a year? How do you measure it? And what you guys are selling?
Sure. So, what we, when we started producing, in late 2021, after our, distillery production area construction was complete, we were doing about, 1200 barrels a year, for a couple of years.
Okay.
We backed off that. We finished our production for the year this year already. So we're just, you know, dumping barrels and bottling at this point. And you know, we have a fair amount in inventory. We have over 3,000 barrels in inventory currently. And, we just are at the point now where we're trying to, just get some product out there in the market and get some pull through, get some reorders and just try to establish our sales.
And who are you using for a distributor?
Well, every state's a different deal. So we have Southern in South Carolina, Southern Glaciers. We have Empire in Georgia and Tennessee.
Okay.
I have New York Wine and Spirits, which is Manhattan beer in New York City. I have Greenlight, Florida. I have Heritage Wine and Spirits in Kentucky and Texas Spirits in Texas.
So, and what are those, are all those deals very similar or are they all different?
Well, so every state has different laws and different taxes that, that alcohol is subject to. So depending on, you know, what state you're in, you can't have, it's hard. If you want to, if you're a supplier like we are, and you want to have a consistent retail price on the shelf,
right,
in every market, then you have to be a little bit flexible on what your price is to your distributor, because the taxes are all different.
Right.
And the cost to transport the, you know, depending on where you're going, going to Georgia is one thing, going to Texas is a whole different thing.
Right.
Right. So you have to be flexible on that end. And so we've determined that it's our best interest to have a pretty consistent price on the shelf for our core whiskeys. That's, you know, for three of them, that's basically $50. So, try to make it accessible, not a stretch for people.
Right.
We have a new whiskey, a new bourbon just came out called Johnny Fever Small Batch, and it's on the shelf for $40, and it's new to most markets. It's not everywhere yet, but, you know, just try to make it where people don't have to hesitate.
Right.
Where you can look at that and be like, yeah, I'm going to try that.
And are these distributors, are they like guaranteeing a certain amount of sales or anything like that?
No, I wish it worked that way.
I was talking to Devil's River down in Texas, and they had Sazerac as their distributor who was guaranteeing them like, I don't know, 500,000 barrels a year or something like that. And then they, when they didn't deliver, when Sazerac didn't deliver, you're like, how is Sazerac not delivering on that? I mean, that's like really pretty small for them, and they own Buffalo Trace. So, right. I mean, you know, and all these other, you know, Pappy, all these other brands and everything like that. How in the world are they not delivering on this? But when they didn't make their quota, you know, Devil's River asked for the, you know, like, well, we want to cut you out. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we have your whiskey already. We can't give it back to you because some law prevents us from shipping it back to you.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so now they're stuck. They can't distribute to any of the states they used to distribute to because the inventory is sitting in Sazerac's basement.
All right. Wow.
I'm like, this is like a mess.
That's crazy.
It's a real mess. And yeah, they ended up declaring bankruptcy, and it's just a real mess. And
yeah,
these deals are all, that's why I ask about the deals, because they're, yeah, I'm an old finance guy, you know, and it's like, it's just interesting to me to see how these things go right and how they go wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that for us, it's really, for distributors, it's a partnership. And you try to engage your sales force.
Yeah.
To, I always tell our distributors, like we're not the biggest brand on any of the, for any of these distributors that we have out there. And I was like, I don't want all your sales force's attention. I just want the appropriate amount of attention at the right time. So,
right,
you know, try to stay, you know, present in their mind share, and just like, you know, try to find some really solid, you know, a few solid sales reps that keep you top of mind.
Right.
Makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's how you start. And it's a long process. It's hard. It's one bottle at a time, you know, one drink at a time, one taste at a time.
Right.
So it's the ground game. It's not pretty or sexy. It's just like, it's the grind.
Yep.
But that's consumer product goods in a nutshell.
So all y'all who thought you were just going to go out and start your own distillery in the backyard. Yeah. That was me once upon a time. Right. I thought, oh, this would be fun. Maybe I should do that.
Yeah.
Come on. No.
I've talked to some founders that, you know, have a brand that does, you know, minimal sales, and they just like, we just need somebody to sell our brand. And it's like, well, you should have thought of that before you created
the brand, right? For sure.
So,
do you do any like flavored whiskeys or anything like that?
We have a product called Sin Eater, and it's a cinnamon whiskey.
Okay.
We make it with our Palmer Stretch rye whiskey. So it's like, you know, it's an 80 proof product. It's not Fireball. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have an aversion to cinnamon whiskey because they've had a bad Fireball experience.
That's what everybody thinks of. Cinnamon whiskey like Fireball?
Well, that and rye whiskey, people's like, oh, I don't like rye whiskey. And it's like, well, I just don't think you've had a rye whiskey that's any good.
Right.
So let's just start with that. So, but, you know, that the Sin Eater is kind of fun and kind of a funky packaging and brand, but it's really tasty and it does really great in cocktails. We do a bourbon cream as well. And a 50-50 of Sin Eater and bourbon cream is like, it's like fall in a glass.
Right.
It's so good. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Any like honey or any of that? Or
so we've done some coffee. We've done some finished whiskeys where we gave a beekeeper a barrel. He put honey in it and let it sit until the barrel started leaking so bad he had to dump it because the honey doesn't keep the barrel, you know,
airtight.
Doesn't keep it moist.
Oh, okay.
So it'll dry the barrel out. So a dry barrel just leaks like a sieve, right?
Right.
And then he bottled that honey and we, you know, co-branded, put a label on it, and then got the barrel back from him. We hydrated it with some steam and then put some whiskey in it, and it was really tasty. Done the same thing with maple syrup. So we have some barrel aged maple syrup that we sell in our gift shop that we then get those barrels back from the maple syrup maker and put whiskey in those too. So that's pretty much what we, and that's, those are small distillery only kind of additions, a couple hundred bottles, 150 bottles, something like that. So
I was just out to dinner with some friends and, you know, they listened to the podcast and we were talking about it and they're like, oh, you know, and she's like, yeah, but I don't really drink whiskey. And she's like, but then on your podcast, you talked about these flavored whiskey. I didn't know you guys did that. And I'm like, oh, there's so much out there. I mean, there's, I was talking to one guy and his number one seller is an agave bourbon.
Interesting.
It mixed and it's, it, he's like, hey, it's mainly sold south of the border. You know, in Mexico and Latin America, it is what they want. It's sweet bourbon.
And agave whiskey.
Bourbon's already kind of sweet. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, you know, but you do add sugar to make an old fashioned. So that's, I guess, true. Agave is one way to go.
That's true.
So that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. But it's interesting to find out about all these different things. Do you guys do anything besides bourbon and whiskey?
Yeah, we have vodkas. We have a couple of gins. Have some moonshines. One of those is an iced coffee moonshine that's made with some macerated beans from a local grind, the grind roasters. And then the bourbon cream, we have that. Right. We actually did an agave spirit, so we can't call it tequila because we're not in Mexico, but we distilled an agave spirit here, put it in a barrel for a little less than a year. So it's a Reposado agave. It's got a lot of character. If you don't like tequila with character, then this isn't the one for you. But we're proud of it, and it sells well in the tasting room and cocktails and things like that.
Do you do any finishing? Do you try any like experiments on the finishing, like switching barrels or anything?
Yeah, so we just started that. We purchased 4 different wine barrels from a vineyard out in the Pacific Northwest. I can't remember where exactly it is, but we tasted through wine from like the wine types that those barrels had contained and tried to, like, Peter, my distiller, like I said, has a really good palate. So we tried to match up what spirit would go best with, you know, that wine variety and type. And so we have some whiskey and some other stuff in wine barrels and we'll see what it's like. So when we finished up production this year, we had 2 empty barrels that we didn't use. We're out of grain. But it had 2 empty barrels. And so we decided to do a double oaked kind of a trial. So we put Anita's Choice, I believe just Anita's Choice, into those 2 barrels. And we're going to monitor that pretty close because it can get away from you pretty quick. And
it doesn't take long, does it?
Tastes like you're drinking, you know, a piece of plywood or something like that. You know, it's just, I'm not a huge fan of like crazy over oaked type, but I know that you can find that balance.
Yeah.
Where you get a little additional character,
right?
But not too much that it overpowers. You know, it's a pretty delicate bourbon as a kind of a weeded bourbon with character, like I talked about previously. Yeah. So you can't overdo it.
It surprises me that, you know, sometimes it's only like 8 days in a new barrel. Like you take it out of one thing, put it in another. You know, 7 days is great. 8 days is great. 9 days is back.
I could hit the go over the line pretty quick.
It gets to the line pretty quick. So just a little fun question for you, just so we can get to know you a little bit. You know, like if you're driving across the country You know, what are you listening to on a long road trip?
Oh gosh. Kind of like it's just Americana type stuff. I just like, pretty chill music. I'm not a headbanger or anything like that. So, grew up listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen as a young adult. And, so I just like pretty chill music, you know, Drew Holcomb's a good one.
Yeah.
And some things like that. So.
Yeah. And then when you get there, you arrive at your destination, you pull in, you belly up to the bar. What are you hoping they have back there?
A really good whiskey.
A really good whiskey.
Yeah.
Which one would you pick? I mean, let's say they don't have yours, right? I mean, yours is obviously, if yours is on there on the shelf, you're going to go, that's mine. I want that one. But,
you know, if the whiskey selection is like really bad and they have Woodford, I'll just default to that because I know exactly how it's going to taste.
Right.
Because it's like super, super consistent.
Yep.
But I like to just know what the local stuff is like.
Yeah.
And that's what I want people to think about for us. So, so many times, you know, we've had an opportunity with adult kids to take some family trips and things like that. So, a couple of them that come to mind, we went to Jackson, Wyoming 1 year.
Okay.
And that was like an awesome trip.
Very.
And while we were there, you know, bought a bottle of Wyoming whiskey, which is a great whiskey, a good distillery. And, you know, those kind of trips make a connection, the spirit to the place.
Right.
And so, and then we went to Puerto Rico 1 year, and went to a rum distillery and like fell in love with their aged rum that they had. And so, you know, those, they call it Ron de Barolito was the name of the rum, distillery. And so, but those two bottles, I have those in my cabinet at home. And it's like, I pull them out and it takes me right back to that.
Right.
That experience. Right.
Right.
For sure. So that's what I want us to be for people that come to Hilton Head and Bluffton. I want the locals to support us too. And I want visitors to come as well. And I want to just share what we can do with the visitors, and hopefully they'll take a bottle home. And when they open it up or they pull it out of their cabinet, they remember that week at the beach.
That's right.
And that experience where they came out across the bridge to Bluffton and had a great afternoon at Burn Church Distillery. So that's my goal.
And that's why I wore this shirt actually, because I just did a week on the Colorado River.
Yeah.
It's so like on the, and yeah, on the back of the shirt is all the different rapids that right. are named, like yeah. hundreds of different rapids on the Colorado River and stuff like that. And, you know, so, you know, it's like, okay, well, how can I bring my bourbon on a trip? You know, it's like, well, you had to bring an empty water bottle and then you stop at this little convenience liquor store right before you get on the river. And they supposedly had some things you could buy. And I'm like, oh boy, I can't imagine what this is. Yeah. What's the selection going to be like here? Right. They had basically no whiskey at all, but they had one bottle and, you know, like, back in the back here, okay, one bottle of Buffalo Trace. That was it. It's the only thing they had. So I carried the Buffalo Trace in this water bottle, and you know, the river's cold.
Oh yeah,
it's 100 degrees in the canyon, but the river's only 58 degrees. So they throw your water bottle overboard in a drag bag that's clipped to the raft, and it keeps it cold the whole time because okay. the water bottle takes a beating.
Oh yeah,
but it. You know, you got nice, cold, nice bourbon every night at the campfire. You know?
Nice.
It's like, so,
nice.
Yeah. And so you do, just like you're saying, you connect the spirit with the place. And so I'll always think of the Grand Canyon when I think of that.
Yep.
And, you know, people, when they come here and they try your whiskey, and it's like, they're always going to connect that with Hilton Head.
That's the hope.
And Hilton Head is a fabulous place, and the whiskey is fabulous whiskey. So, oh, there you go. Fantastic. Well, listen, we really thank you for the time today.
It was fun.
This has been a lot of fun, and we've learned a lot about what it is you're doing down here, and I encourage everybody to come and check it out, and that's what I'm going to do next is check this out. And I've had their whiskey before, but I'm going to have it again because it's been a few years, and I want to try it again because, you know, I forget, you know, and it's like, okay, let's try this again.
Yeah, it's different.
Yeah, I'll bet. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Of course, thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks for being here.
Okay, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, it is time for the shenanigans portion of our episode. And I thought we would review the three most craziest, exciting, surprising things that happened in the NFL on Sunday. All right. Number one. Well, let's start with number three. We'll count down. All right. We'll count down. The Steelers beat the Ravens. Are you kidding me? The Steelers were absolutely awful last week against Buffalo. Then they go on the road and they beat a pretty good team. Lamar playing really well. They beat a pretty good Ravens team. This is classic Mike Tomlin. Lose games you should win. Win games you should lose. End up with a 500 record. Get knocked out of the playoffs in the first round. This is how it goes with the Mike Tomlin Steelers. The third most surprising thing, the Steelers actually beat the Ravens. I don't even know how that happened. Tomlin made so many mistakes in coaching. Let's just look at the fourth quarter for a brief second. The Steelers had three possessions in the fourth quarter, beginning at the 13-minute mark of the fourth quarter. 13 minutes left in the game, the Steelers get the ball. I said to myself, oh no, here comes the Tomlin turtle. This is when we refuse to play offense because it's too risky. We'd rather have our defense on the field, which really isn't that good. They're like 31 in the league in pass defense or something like that. Not a great defense this year. But hey, we'd rather do that than put our offense out there. I don't know why. So they run one of those stupid little screen plays out to the right. Doesn't get anything, a yard, 2 yards. Then they run the ball. Doesn't get anything, 2 or 3 yards. Then I think they had a penalty next. And then it was like 3rd and 11, and it's incomplete. 3 and out. That was the first 3 and out. The next time they got the ball, another 3 and out. The next time they got the ball, another 3 and out. Do you think they're even trying to play offense? I don't think so. I don't think they're trying to play offense at all. And they just let the Ravens have the ball back. Let's just let the Ravens continue to try to score, and they'll probably screw up, which they did. This is just, it's a coin flip, right? That's why he's always 500. It's a coin flip whether they're going to screw up or we're going to screw up. That's how it boils down. So the third most surprising thing, the Steelers beat the Ravens. The second and more surprising thing than the Steelers win was Jacksonville beating Indianapolis. Now, if you've been listening to Whiskey Shenanigans, you've heard me say that Indy is a sham, that they're not that good, that they're going nowhere. Yeah, they're going nowhere. They lost their quarterback yesterday. They're going nowhere. So first string quarterback is down. I believe the second string quarterback was already out with an injury. We're going on third string quarterback in Indy, and they are sinking fast. Jacksonville has taken over the lead in that division, and they will win that division. That is the second most surprising thing in the NFL this weekend. But the number one, take the cake. Most surprising thing in the NFL this past Sunday, the Texans beat Kansas City. Kansas City's done. They are out. Now, I know you're going to tell me they're mathematically still possible that they could get in as a wild card or whatever. They're done. They've got nothing. They have three good players on that team. I think you all know who they are. Mahomes, Kelsey, and that Chris something or other, number 95, defensive lineman. Great players. The rest of the team, they're okay. Especially on offense, they're pretty good. But they're not good enough. They're not good enough. And Kansas City, a team that's won that division, I think, 10 years in a row. They've been to like, how many Super Bowls? They've won 3 Super Bowls, and they've been to like, seems like we used to call the Super Bowl the New England Patriots Invitational Bowl because it was the New England Patriots and somebody else every year. But for the past 7 years, 8 years, it's been the Kansas City Invitational Bowl. And it's just been Kansas City and somebody else, because Buffalo could never seem to beat them. Well, here we are. Buffalo's not going to have to beat them. Buffalo's not even in first place in that division. Kansas City's in third place in that division. It's a mess. Kansas City's done. They're cooked. So those are the three most surprising things in the NFL this past weekend. Hope you enjoyed it, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. It was short. It was sweet. But, you know, what are you going to do? When there's only a few surprises now, some people will say, yeah, I know. What about the Green Bay-Chicago game? Who cares? Chicago, are they really that good? Yeah, they're pretty good. They're surprisingly good. The Vikings blanked Washington. Another team in that division, and the Vikings are in that division as well. They crushed Washington. Okay. Weird, right? I mean, just strange, but those don't make the top three. Sorry. Those are surprises. They don't make the top three. The Texans beating Kansas City is all the rage. It's what it's all about. And everybody's going to talk about Indianapolis's quarterback going down with a Achilles injury. So he's out. See you next year. I think his name's Mac Jones. See you next year, Mac Jones. It's going to be a year. And then after a year, are you really the same player? Takes another year to really get back to where you were before. So, and his contract is up after this year. So I don't know what Indianapolis is going to do. And that guy was going to be a prized free agent because of what he's done in Indy. Not now. That's a shame. Feel bad for the guy. Nobody wants to see a guy go down with an injury. So anyway, thanks for tuning in, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. See you in the next episode. How did it become Dueling Grounds?
So in the early 1800s, at an area right located on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee, which is where we sit, along the Cumberland Trace, which is now essentially I-65 going north, there was a little area right on the border that was known as Lincoln Pinch, and it was famous for hosting pistol duels. Over 40 documented duels happened there on the grounds at Lincoln Pinch, the most famous of which would have been Sam Houston. And then several others, and it probably wouldn't surprise you that most of the duels were between lawyers and politicians.
I assume Sam Houston won, but
yeah. Yeah. And actually he did not, it was kind of considered a bit, it wasn't necessarily it was not the intention to kill your opponent. The intention was to draw first blood. As a matter of fact, if you were to kill your opponent outright, you could find yourself up on murder charges.